My grandparents were immigrants from Italy, all four of them. They were very poor. On my mother's side, they were illiterate. My father's side, they just had a few years of education. My father worked in a factory, and my mother was a secretary. And this was an Italian neighborhood in the town that I grew up. So it was mostly immigrant families like ourselves. Pretty much everybody worked in the General Electric factory. That was the main employer for our town for many years. They had a plastics division, and they made transformers, but they also made parts for submarines, nuclear submarines. So no doubt a lot of it was war, but not all of it. I was the first one to go to college. My undergraduate degree was in engineering. I'm not sure why, but I think I was just directed to something that seemed very practical and at the time lucrative. I did get a degree in electrical engineering, but by the time I graduated, there was so much going around me, you know, in the 60s. A lot of turbulence, a lot of counterculture activity, and I was very much drawn to it, even though I felt as though I was on the outside looking in. I didn't feel as though I could relate to the people. They seemed more upper class, more free, more socially gifted, and I was withdrawn. But it was something very attractive, something very creative and alive. So when I finished my degree in engineering, I then decided to go to graduate school in political science. I went for a year, and I received my master's degree in political science, but then I had to do something with my military obligation. And so I had a choice. I could take a chance on my draft number. They were drafting then, and I was in the middle. I could go to Canada. And at the time, my political thinking wasn't so far developed that that was even an option. So I decided instead to join the Air Force, because if I joined the Air Force, I had a good chance at just sitting behind a desk. Problem was, it was a four-year obligation. But that's what I did. So I joined the Air Force. But it was very interesting because I was in intelligence. So I had access to a lot of top secret information. And I had various jobs that enabled me to see how the U.S. conducted various operations around the world. I could see a lot of top secret information and then look at the newspapers and see what was reported and what was not reported. I spent 2 years in Korea, which at that time was a dictatorship, and contrasting that with the propaganda that we were told about why we're there and so on. So my 4 years was educational. Also, just in terms of being in the military and what you could say, what you could not say, what everybody was either saying or believing about the Vietnam War. And we talked to, you know, many of the people. I almost was sent to Vietnam, but the orders were stopped. But I talked to so many people who were in Vietnam, and I got a pretty good understanding of what was going on. So then when I returned to the U.S., I decided to continue my education in political science. Then I received my Ph.D. at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And I was fortunate enough at the time, this was in the early 70s, to be involved in a department in which there were a handful of leftist academics in political science. But also in the same building, there was an economics department that was very Marxist, a lot of Marxist scholarship. This was in the early 70s. So I would take courses in the economics department and courses in the political science department. I became very interested in political economy, looking at the world through a political economic lens in order to explain what is happening and what is our history and so on. And because I came from a working class background and my experiences with my family and people I grew up with, I found this education to be extraordinarily illuminating, because for the first time I could better understand who I was and where I came from and why I felt certain things. So it made perfectly good sense. From that point forward, I tried to get various teaching jobs in the U.S. I taught at many different universities, but I would only get a one-year job. And during that time frame, inevitably, something would happen where I would take sides with the students or with some issue, and before you know it, without even trying, I was in trouble. And so I would never be rehired. And this is, I would go from job to job like this. I said, I don't know how anyone can exist in these institutions because you don't have to look for trouble. It just comes to you. Some student asks you something, would you speak at our rally? Would there's something happening in the department where decisions are made that you might object to or something. Or the university was doing something. The more I taught at the universities, I began to be critical of the university as a structure in terms of what is their purpose, who goes to the university, who doesn't go to the university. Before too long, I realized that I had no chance of really having a career as an academic. And moreover, I really didn't like it too much. I liked reading. I liked teaching. But to be honest, I had trouble with the faculty and I had trouble with the students. Not all the students, but a number of students because they come from very wealthy, privileged backgrounds. I don't know. I had a difficult time trying to explain the world. From my point of view, they were more interested in getting their degree so they'd become a lawyer or whatever. They didn't want to hear this, so it was difficult. So eventually, when I was 40, I decided that's enough with academia, and I went to San Francisco. I had always painted. My grandmother was an amateur painter, so I said, I will try to make a living as an artist. And I eventually did. I was there for 12 years. And during that time, I began to organize artists to try to create independent ways of exhibiting so that artist A could make a living, have control over the distribution of the work, have control over the aesthetic of the work. And from that position, then they could choose or not choose to be involved with galleries or competitions or grants or whatever. I had some success, but by and large, I felt that artists are among the most individualistic people. The education that they get is not very broad, generally doesn't have to do with politics or history very much, and certainly has nothing to do with the history of art in the U.S., which I was very interested in. How did this movement happen? Why did Jackson Pollock become a star? Why does Andy Warhol become a star? Who doesn't become a star? That kind of thing. I was very interested in that. And they weren't. So as I said, I had some success in organizing independent exhibitions. But then my wife wanted to explore Italy. And I felt that continuing what I was doing in San Francisco was very, very difficult. So I said, okay, I'll move. And here I am. In a castle in Leno. I was told, I didn't believe it, but I was told that this book will really make it difficult for you to get a job. And I find that throughout my entire life, I'm always naive. I'm always shocked that I'm shocked. Especially if your field is something like political science. Political economy, which was my real interest, really doesn't exist. I was trying to piece together some politics and some economics. But in terms of a career, in terms of job definitions and so on, my area was American government within political science. And the reason why I wrote this book was because I arrived at University of California at Santa Cruz in 87, I think. And my job was to pick up where one professor left off. He was on sabbatical, so I inherited his course structure. One of the courses that I had to teach was called The Founding of the American Government or something like that. And it turned out, because it was 1987, that it was the bicentennial year of the Constitution being written. I didn't know that much about it, and so I had to do research. I was always just about 2 weeks ahead of the students. But the more I read, the more I was shocked. I said, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. No one told me that. You mean a majority of the people are against the Constitution? Why were they against the Constitution? So I would read more and read more. And eventually I wrote that book. You know, it's interesting because today so many people on the right will castigate people on the left. But I think they need to understand. If you look at people who are critical of the U.S. Constitution or political economy, I mean, we all began believing in the story. I mean, I was as patriotic as you could get when I was 16 years old. I mean, I wanted to go fight the communists. I loved Jack Kennedy. I thought the U.S. was great. I was going to do my duty. I mean, I just swallowed everything hook, line, and sinker. But before I knew it, I was almost sent to Vietnam. I ended up in the military. I had a good look at the military. I worked with people whose job it was to drop nuclear weapons on China and the Soviet Union and North Korea. I saw their planes. I saw the bombs. I saw the top secret documents. I saw all of that. And at the same time, there were protests, there were civil rights movements, there was a women's movement, gay movements, environmental movements, all these movements swirling around. And little by little by little, I began to, in effect, get an education. And I really began to identify with what I thought were the most patriotic and creative people in American history, and they seemed always to be the people on the bottom. It was, you know, the Irish immigrants. It was the slaves. It was the woman. It was the labor unions. You know, all these people who fought and resisted and triumphed and gave to the U.S. public education, the 8-hour day, environmental legislation. It's so interesting today when you hear all the propaganda about Iraq or whatever war, how they are defending our freedom. Well, if you really look at where the freedoms come from, whether it's the Bill of Rights or the 8-hour day or freedom of speech, it comes from people who resisted, who protested, who got arrested, who went to jail, who were killed, and fought for those expansions of the constitutions. And so it really ought to be on the 4th of July, or if we value the freedom of speech, that we need to pay homage to the activists, the people who risked, the people who resisted power, the people who fought against the Constitution. All the big names, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, George Washington, James Madison, obviously, Thomas Jefferson, the founding fathers. I use the term framers just so that it's, you know, not so sexist, because it wasn't just men who were involved. But in any case, I think it's easy in terms of giving examples to think, whoever is listening to this, think about where you live. For example, I live now in Leno, Italy, and it's not much different. There are people, probably rich families, rich individuals who own lots of property. And what do they want? They want opportunity to make more money, to develop their property in some way. They're always thinking about the next entrepreneurial project, investment, development. Okay, well, these were the framers. These were the framers, and that's why they fought a war of independence, to be free from Great Britain, to do with the property as they saw fit. And on one level, it's absolutely true. They were seeking freedom from the aristocracy to do with property as they please. This was a step forward, I think, historically, so that as individual property owners, they would have the freedom to develop property as they wanted, free from the church, free from moral restriction, free from tradition. However, they had a problem, because in order to fight the revolution, they needed a lot of foot soldiers, a lot of farmers, a lot of poor people who didn't own property. And after the revolution, the problem became quite obvious, because these people the ordinary farmers who were in debt, who didn't own property, had a different concept of what America ought to be. The Constitution that governed the U.S. from 1776 to 1787 was quite different than the Constitution that was written in 1787. And in fact, when the Constitution was written in 1787, it was at a crisis, because there were armed rebellions in every single state. Of all the 13 states in the colonies, there was disruption and resistance and rebellion. In Massachusetts, for example, Daniel Shea, who was a general in the Revolutionary Army, had 1,000 men. He was literally marching on Boston. And so these framers rushed to Philadelphia to grab back the political and economic apparatus so that they could finally establish the kind of political and economic control that they had sought when they began to think in terms of independence from Great Britain. And therefore, they had to deal with the ordinary people, who, by the way, were not called people. When they say the people, they meant the people with property. Someone says, we the people, means we the people of property. So what to do with all these other people? Well, James Madison, who was considered the father of the Constitution, said afterwards, we have devised, you know, a wonderful Constitution. It's in some ways a medieval Constitution. And its virtue is that it creates the appearance of public participation without really giving the public a voice. I mean, people ought to know this. This is in the Federalist Papers. James Madison, again, the father of the Constitution, said, forever across time, there are two opposing factions, one who owns property, one who doesn't. They're forever in conflict. And it is the job of the government to protect, using his words, the opulent few against the interested and overbearing majority. That is the fault line across modern history. The people without want their share, and they resist, and it puts pressure on the people who have. The people who have write these documents, these constitutions that have all this pretty language, but the real decision makers are the people with property, and that's true up through the present. George Washington was the richest man in America, not unlike Berlusconi, who was the prime minister of Italy, and that in order to vote, you had to have initially, I think it was something like 50 acres and a certain amount of money. And it's not just concentration of wealth, it's the greater secrecy of decision-making. In other words, the Constitution can say, you know, the Congress will decide on the budget, for example. But the budget is basically given to the executive from corporations, and then from the executive is passed on to the legislature and introduced to the legislature. And eventually, you know, with some negotiation becomes the budget. So a lot of these decisions and the formulation of legislation really begins in the corporate boardrooms and is handed to people who represent the people in boardrooms. Another example would be the war decision-making powers and how that has been taken away from Congress and now seems to be made within the executive exclusively. So as time goes on and as capital gets more and more concentrated, the real decisions are removed further and further away from the public arena. And campaigns are organized around non-issues and so on and so forth. The public does not have a voice. And in fact, if I talk to Americans here in Italy, most of them are unhappy with the Bush administration, unhappy with the war in Iraq, and the question arises, when will the Americans have enough, and when will they protest, and when will they rise up? But when you look at it, what can Americans do? They don't have any organization in which they can voice their views about anything. Labor is pretty much destroyed. Churches are on the margins. The political parties are meaningless. I mean, what do you do with your resentment, your hostility, your disagreement, your desire to have a different set of policies? What do you do with that? The only thing you possibly can do is you can write letters, of course, and vote occasionally. And then the choices presented to you aren't really valid choices, so you're stuck. And moreover, the media itself has become more concentrated, so the way the issues are framed is more and more narrow, so your sense of things just sits with you. You become more alienated, you become a little bit more disenchanted, and probably you turn to satisfaction, your private life, your family, recreation, and so on. And so it's really property owners governing the world with almost no possibility of the public checking them whatsoever. It's almost like a runaway chain. If you look at the distribution of wealth, which has become more and more concentrated, or the decline of the middle class, the median person in the U.S., can that person who lives in a family send their kids to college without worrying so much? Do they have health care? Can they afford to go out to eat once a week, once a month? Can they afford to take a vacation for a few weeks? Answer is no to every one of those questions. You really do see in the U.S. growing inequality. I think probably in the entire period of U.S. history for 200 plus years, there may have been only one period in which you had a significant growing middle class, and that was after World War II. And it's not surprising, because if we look at Europe, and if we look at the U.S., and we look at when do ordinary people get a larger piece of the pie, when do they get a little bit more comfortable, it's always when there's lots of resistance. So if you look at Germany under Bismarck in the 19th century, there's enormous labor agitation, enormous proliferation of theoretical frameworks that challenge capitalism, from Hegel to Marx to anarchists and so on. And so the state then gives them something. Or if you look in the U.S. in the progressive era, so-called progressive era, it's the same thing. Enormous unrest, almost a revolution. So there's some cutting down on the number of hours, some child protection for child labor, some safety with regard to work. And then following World War II, in Europe we had the resistance to fascism being largely communist or socialist. And similarly in the U.S., there's a huge amount of identification with communism and or liberalism or FDR having to create Social Security and other programs so the country did not go left. And in a way, it was saving capitalism. But since World War II, since the early 70s, there was a conscious decision on the part of people who have enormous power in the U.S. to make a turn to the right. And this is what we now refer to as neoliberalism or neoconservatism, where the social wage, meaning the programs that were normally established to help people have access to education, health, and various programs, which they deserve, which they've earned through their work, the decision was to cut back on that. Because following the 60s, the evil threat of democracy had expanded. And people were alarmed at, what are we going to do now? We've got African Americans demanding their just share. We have women doing the same thing. We have students doing the same thing. We need to put them back into their obedient, subservient, marginal position. And one way to do that is to cut the social wage. So you then eventually had the election of Reagan and a rise of religious conservative ideology, the cutting of social programs, the building of this increase of military expenditures. And so we're pretty much back to where we were in the 1920s. I don't know how far they can go. I mean, I was reading a biography of Berlusconi. He began making a lot of money as a developer in Milan. And when you read stories like that, you often think, what possesses someone after they're already a billionaire, already a powerful person who can enjoy life so thoroughly, why do they insist on then climbing to the next level and then to the next level? And for some reason, it seems that these people do. A friend of mine, Michael Parenti, is a writer in the U.S., and has said that when he looked at this, he finally concluded is that what these people want is absolutely everything. There's no, you know, to stop at some point is not enough. And so I think this, you know, this whole debacle in Iraq where the U.S. thought it had an opportunity to really gain control of the world's oil supplies, you know, to put a check on China and Asia and Europe. I mean, you see it there. They've written about it before they went in. I mean, you can see what the plan is. The Soviet Union is no longer a military threat. It doesn't pose any check to us anymore. And so, therefore, now it's our time to really use every power at our disposal to grab the resources of the world and dominate the world. I don't know. Where does it end? But I think you're right in suggesting that the direction is towards fascism, because it's basically the direction is towards the privatization of everything. And as Chomsky points out, a corporation is simply a tyranny where a few people make all the decisions. And so we're getting closer and closer and closer to fewer people controlling enormous assets, controlling the production and distribution of food, where you have copywriting of knowledge that came down through generations of farming. And I think the problem really is that when we look at these problems, we say, oh, the war in Iraq, the problem is Bush. We don't say the problem is the entrepreneurial mind, this individual whose purpose simply is to accumulate as much wealth and property as he or she can. And in fact, if they do it creatively, that's a measure of creativity. I just find it inexplainable why so many people identify with that as a model of freedom and a good life. Because if you know those people, and we all know those people, whenever they get together, whenever they socialize, whenever you talk to them, they're networking constantly. They're always looking for the next person to have a better relationship with. Where can I find investors? For example, I have people, friends of mine here on this gorgeous lake who want to organize weddings because there's a market for weddings. And I'm thinking, do you really enjoy organizing weddings? Why do you want to do this? Next to me is a disco, which has kind of a South Pacific look to it. What's wrong with Lake Como? Can you enjoy Lake Como? No. It's better if I can make money on young people drinking until 4:30 in the morning. I don't care about anything else except that. And then I take my money and I have my private escape. I can go to Sardinia, I can go to the Bahamas, I can own the yacht, and so on. I can understand the appeal of that, obviously. But I don't understand why so many people don't see the shallowness, the emptiness of it. What it does really to the quality of life, how it destroys the lake or the fabric of a community. Yeah, but that's where we are. And so I think that probably through the control of education and the media, many people are unable to frame the problem in its proper way, which I think has more to do with our institutions permitting just a few people to have so much power. I think if we really did have democracy, politically and even economically, then the people who get hurt along the way will have an opportunity to check the people who are accumulating so much. People on the right are always talking about the family, the integrity of the family, and how we need to protect the integrity of the family and the family values and so on. But they will never look at the market. The market in labor as one of the major, if not the major, reason why it is that people are so mobile. We go where the job is. And it almost doesn't matter if you spent 4 years in higher education and now it's time to, you know, to cash in, and you have some corporation that's 2,000 miles away and they're going to offer you the big paycheck and the car and all the privileges. It doesn't matter if you're producing bombs or what you're doing. You take the job and you go. And then you are in the market, and that's not enough. You want a promotion. You're competitive. I mean, Marx talked about this all the time, how as we walk around, we are walking competitors. We see somebody, and immediately, they're not a human being to enjoy or to discover something about, or what is it that you know, what can you teach me? It's always, you're my competitor. How can I either align with you or beat you? And I don't give you a lot of information. I play my cards close to my vest. I mean, you can see this all the time. If you in Italy or even in the U.S., if you talk to people and relate to people who are workers, or here the contadini, people who work with their hands, and what you see is what you get. They're open. They have opinions about everything. They dance. They sing. They argue. But the higher you go, the more professional someone is, the more reserved they are, the more careful they are about letting you know what they think. In fact, you may never know what they think. They're so skilled at smiling at the right time and saying the right things, not to offend anybody, that it's very difficult to enjoy yourself with them, I find. But I think that is just the habit that is cultivated as you need to succeed in that environment where you are now a decision maker, you are now a competitor. I need to play my cards close to my vest because I don't want my competitor to understand what my next move might be. If I trust him to a degree, I may involve him in a common project. But you go to parties, you talk to people, it's just one endless effort to gain the next advantage, to climb the ladder to the next step. It is life without meaning. Everybody is racing for the next contract. There is no social sense of self. I think more so in Europe, because Europe comes out of the Middle Ages, and so I think there's a legacy of tradition, I think there's a legacy of mutual responsibility, and some degrees maybe a legacy of the church in some ways, far more so than the U.S., which never had any of that. But I think what you're talking about, this mobility thing, this failure to identify with anything larger than the individual, means that when push comes to shove, for example, in the U.S. now, where I think so many people look at what's happening in Iraq and are really worried in that not only are civil liberties being curtailed, but we're also on the verge of World War III in terms of the possibility of an attack on Iran. We're also on the verge of some huge international economic collapse. But people who participate in this have no allegiance to anything. Because as people who defend the market will say, they will say this, look, if you look across history, you can see in the Middle Ages, you can see various church leaders and so on, who wanted to impose the good on the rest of the population and always ended in disaster. So, therefore, the virtue of the market is that each person can pursue his or her own self-interest. And by virtue of doing that, the aggregate group of people individually pursuing their self-interest will result in the greater good. Except for the fact, and then they also admit this, that if there is a crisis in that situation, there is no identification with something maybe other than the family. In Italy, certainly it's the family. In the U.S., maybe even less so. So beyond the family, there is no community. What community? There are no labor unions. I don't like labor unions. They're corrupt. I don't like being told what to do. Church is, you know, something you go to on Sunday. It doesn't provide any services in the community. There is no community. People don't like government. They fear government. There is no organizational counterweight to the powers that be. And that is super frightening, because in the past you did have the civil rights movement in the 60s, they used the church. Labor unions used unions. I think maybe in previous times, political parties, corrupt as they were, nonetheless, had bosses and were independent from business people to a degree and so on. But today there are no organizations to turn to. For example, before I left the U.S., I was taking an Italian class. And in the Italian class, someone was very upset by the fact that they had gone to a concert. And at the concert, this was an indoor concert, and the balcony, someone threw a banner over the balcony that said, whatever it said, you know, get out of Iraq or something. And they were so upset by this. They were saying, well, this is not the place. This is a concert. But you have to ask yourself, where is the place? There is no place for the place. Where do you go? You go to a labor union? I'm sorry, we're talking about safety issues. You go to the church? No, this is getting to heaven. You know, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Parents Association. I mean, every organization has its little purpose. There is no organization where you can go and talk about the invasion of Iraq. Maybe a political party, but the political parties really don't exist. If you attend anything having to do with political parties, it's always those few little active Democrats or Republicans who are maneuvering to run for office or get a job for someone who's running for office. It's not really where, it's not a grassroots thing where people talk about issues and raise issues and, you know, and it's brought forward. Not at all. So there is absolutely no place where you can unfurl your banner, talk about peace, talk about justice, talk about all these issues that seem to be so important. There is no place, which reinforces the notion that James Madison was quite successful, that they created a political structure where there is the appearance of public participation, but there really is no public participation. There really is no public voice. Europe pretty much conquered the world. And the U.S. is an offshoot of that. And I know the framers had empire very much in mind. They used the word all the time. And I think of John Locke as someone who's promulgating a philosophy that will help to justify the new property rights. And that, you know, he thinks about various possibilities and says, yes, it is okay for someone to exploit the land or exploit someone else's labor and accumulate all that, because this will result in development, and development is good, and so on. And Rousseau talks about the problems began when the first person looked at a piece of land and declared it and said, this is mine. So I tend to think more and more about people's self-understanding, that they see themselves as industrious people. They have the right to develop and the right to take. This is consistent with God's interest. In fact, if I accumulate a lot, if I'm industrious, I will go to heaven. If I'm lazy, I won't. So I see the Protestant ethic, the Protestant Reformation, individualism, property rights as explaining a lot of that. But you may be right. There may be so many other things that support it as well. I tend to think that the economy is really the driving force because, for example, you would have to find a situation where some property owner who was about to develop something did not because of his fear of the unknown or fear of space or something. In other words, you'd have to find some example where which dynamic really triumphs. And it seems to me that the dynamic that triumphs is, it's a very selfish, individualistic determination, almost like a calculation. When I get up in the morning, when I walk out of the house, do I go left or do I go right? And it's almost as though we take out a little calculator which says, if you go left, you will make more money. I'm going to go that left. I mean, we make decisions. What is the good job? The good job is the one that makes more money, you know. What can we do next? I mean, I think about this all the time because we're impacted it all the time. This disco, for example, began, and I spoke with these people, when the rich kids of the few families in town who, and the mayor is part of this, decided that we can make a disco. And so you have to ask yourself, why would they want to make a disco? Did they like disco? Are they interested in the youth's drinking and dancing at night? Why do they want to do this? A, because they think they can make money. The other side of the coin is they never ask the question, what will it do to the community? Is the community interested in this? Maybe they need playgrounds for the kids. Maybe they need continuing education. What do they need? Nobody cares. I care about myself, and when I think about myself, it has to do with owning more, accumulating more, being a privileged person in my little space, it seems that this seems to be, this is what is called freedom. And so we think about all these problems in the world, but no one wants to stop and say, you know what the problem is? The problem is freedom, because that would sound so terrible. And I would never say it that way because it sounds contradictory. But the problem might be our concept of freedom, or our concept of what does it mean to be a human being? What is in our interest? One of my professors had this one statement that always stuck in my mind, and it had to do with what he called the common interest. So you ask yourself, what is the common interest? And you might say, well, it's what we all have in common. What do we have in common? Well, we all need clean air, clean water. We all need some creative work. We all need health care. We all need access to education. So you could start to build some of these things. But in our time and place, the common interest equals the aggregate of private interests. It's every single individual going out each day to compete in the marketplace and to grab something. And collectively, if we can support this and encourage this, this is the common interest. But as you suggested, that kind of actually aggregated private interest undermines what we might normally think of as the common interest. Because if we think of the common interest, then it might be that the government has to say to some rich family, I'm sorry, you cannot build a disco. You cannot have a giant boat that goes so fast that it ruins something. Government saying to entrepreneurs, I'm sorry, but you cannot have the freedom as an individual to have your business the way you want your business. This is the big fear. Because, yes, that's right. It could issue in some kind of gulag if we took it many steps out. It's true. But that does not deny the fact that we need to think of those problems as well as the problems that we have and figure out some solution as we go along. But right now, if it's not about private enterprise, it's not discussed. It's off the charts. I think we ought to start listing in order what is of value. If we began that way, just stop for a moment, don't worry about your job and so on. You live in a particular community. What is it that the community values? What's a priority? What comes first? Maybe health. Health seems to be so central. Health, okay, well, what does that entail? It's safety at work. It means the water. We should clean up the lake. We should make sure we have clean air. Education. Yes, I agree completely. Satisfaction, fulfillment, social relationships, time off. I had one student who said to me, and she was a successful interior decorator. She says, oh, I'm so busy. I have no time for myself. What should I do? I need time for myself. Well, I didn't want to say anything. But I really, if I had the chance, I would say, well, you just told me you have three houses. Do you really need three houses? And the three houses are all over the United States. What does it take to maintain three houses in different parts of the country so that when you arrive, you have a car, you have probably have a maid and so on? Well, of course, you have to work 60 hours a week. What do you really value? But see, the problem is, I think, that we've gotten so far away from doing things that we find satisfying that even if we're retired, we don't know what to do. We do, you know, we do little things. We play tennis, we play golf, we, you know, watch a movie, we read a book, we go out to eat. None of those things, nothing wrong with any of those things. But who are you? What is your song? What is your gift? Have you found it? Have you expressed it? Have you struggled with it? Have you developed it? I mean, those kind of things. It's not that we're just consumers of all these little recreational activities, but because in our lifetime, we grow up, and growing up means submitting to authority, getting the good job, pleasing your parents, and for the next 40 years, whatever we do, we have no interest in it really, because the first thing we think about is retiring. And then when we're retired, we still don't, we haven't discovered the joy of being who we are. I teach art now. And the connection for me is And I constantly emphasize with regard to painting, it's not about the painting. The painting is paint on canvas. It's almost worthless. The value is you discovering the joy and fulfillment of making marks on canvas. You discover the fulfillment of seeing more deeply into something. So I think politically, in terms of, say, organizing against the war or organizing for immigrant rights or whatever happens to be, yes, there's always those objectives, but the real objective is, can you create a situation where people now begin to discover their own power, their own ability to find fulfillment by speaking, by writing, by thinking, by talking? That really is what the powers fear. They fear democracy. They fear independence, because that will take control away from them in an instant. Because you don't need any of that anymore. You get a group of people who can manage on their own. And I think one of the most important periods was this, you know, the Spanish Revolution that led to the Spanish Civil War and the accomplishments there and so on, how people took control of their own way of life. That always has to be smashed. Always has to be smashed. And I think as an artist, I think of the, you know, Picasso's painting of Guernica, and I'm amused by art critics and artists' reaction to the painting, because they will say things, oh, it's a great political painting, it's anti-war, it's whatever it is. And I always ask, why was Guernica bombed? What was that about? Yes, we know the horrors of war, but as soon as you say the horrors of war, it's become so trivial. It's anti-war. Oh, really? Is it anti-war? Maybe it's anti-fascist. Maybe it's pro-anarchist. Who knows? I mean, it's more than just some simple little thing. So you take this great painting in the context of the art world, and it trivializes what is the paramount question. What happened in Spain such that they, the powers that be, the fascists, the communists, the U.S., that they had to smash this and obliterate this one town? Why? And the answer is, because these people got control of their lives. There was some democracy. There was some real artists, not making paintings, creating a life that had to be smashed. That is the great fear. Because unless you smash that, a few people cannot govern. A few people cannot control everything. A few people cannot be extraordinarily wealthy. I don't care what field, if it's art or politics or whatever. If a few have so much and so many have so little, you must block concepts of democracy. You must block the history where people had democracy, where people had a voice, where workers were intelligent people who did many different things. This must be obliterated. I think in the U.S., unless it's on the media, it's not real. Until someone turns on the TV and says, you people are exploited, no one's ever going to feel exploited. It must come through that tube. There is. We interrupt this program with an important bulletin. Everyone pays attention. Now there's a crisis. The U.S. has invaded Iraq. Until that moment, there's no invasion of Iraq. It's defending freedom. It's, you know, protecting us from weapons of mass destruction. No, it's so true. And I'm sure you know friends. I will complain about something, and until they read it in a book or some accepted authority, it doesn't matter. The question is not how do we get rid of Bush. The question is, how do we get rid of the system that requires Bush? We need an imbecile president who has, you know, such a shallow sense of history, who is privileged beyond belief, and is only capable of repeating the most simple, illusionary ideas. We need that person to be president, even more so than in the past. I mean, I think if you look at Franklin Roosevelt or Eisenhower, JFK or Nixon, whether they were good guys or bad guys, they were smart, capable of thinking on their own, capable of being independent. This is a big danger today. You can't even have that kind of politician. You need the Ronald Reagans. and you need the George Bushes. And I think to that degree, Clinton was a problem. Even though he presided over enormous economic growth and enormous money being shifted to the upper classes, the powers that be want really a PR person that they can control.
So you're right. The question is, we need to understand why a political economy absolutely needs someone like George Bush to be president. He's in many ways the perfect president. He does not pose a threat to the ruling class. He does exactly what they want. Maybe he's not perfect because he's such an imbecile, people can see that. You know, actually, who probably was maybe the perfect president was Ronald Reagan. Equally as imbecilic, but I would always say, you know what, he could do good. He could read really well. I think the U.S. is in a very difficult period in its history, and it does need war. I would think it needs war, maybe less for the economy, but more to keep the population under control. Because as long as you can claim, you know, the enemy is coming, the more the domestic population is likely to submit to all sorts of measures against it. But I think the U.S. is in big trouble because the constant need to expand its economy. After World War II, it was the hegemonic power. By 1973, it really had problems controlling the world the way it had. The gold standard was taken away from the dollar, and there were different shifts going on. And today, I think where you see it, a European Union rising, and I think where you see China rising, India rising, Russia being more independent and more apt to align with China and India, and especially in the Middle East, where the U.S. is, I mean, this is why Bush will be the worst president of all time, even by the standards of the ruling classes, because he's created a situation where it's, at this point in time, the Shiite coalition extending from Iran into Iraq and possibly into Saudi Arabia is apt to gain control of the world's oil resources. I mean, what a debacle is that? Just at the point where the U.S., in order to maintain its empire, needs to gain control to block Europe and Asia. And Europe and Asia, they must be aware of the fact that this is an opportunity, that the U.S. is not going to be the hegemonic power. So, yes, the U.S. is really, I hope that, and it's unlikely, but I mean, after World War II, I don't know British history well enough to know, at what point did the ruling class in Britain decide, okay, it was good while it lasted, but we're not king of the world anymore. So now we'll take a subservient place. And the only way out of some third world war would be for the U.S. to accept the fact that it's not the super hegemonic hyperpower that it thought it could be once the Soviet Union declined. That there are these other coalitions, and it ought to begin to relate to them in a diplomatic way as opposed to a military way. I'm sure you're aware of the Project for a New American Century and you know all these writings that took place in the 90s. And then you had the election in 2000 where the choice is going to be Al Gore or Bush. And it seems there, that's where the ruling class intervened through the Supreme Court to ensure that George Bush, i.e. the neocons, would control power. So I really wonder, I mean, there must have been something that Al Gore represented, you know, the Democratic Leadership Council, the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, in terms of interest within the ruling class, in terms of sectors of the economy, who make these kinds of decisions that they felt worried about. Certainly, I think, just in terms of who would you want as president, Al Gore or George Bush? George Bush is far more attractive candidate because he's so easily manipulated. Well, Al Gore represents someone who's capable of thinking independently. So it could have been that. But my guess is that you would have to look at, if I were to ask this question in any kind of research way, I'd have to look at the U.S. economy and identify growth sectors. High-tech sectors, capital-intensive sectors, labor-intensive sectors, and so on, and see which how are they coalescing? What do they perceive as their agenda? And what do they want the state to do? And maybe because the neocons so publicly and clearly articulated an agenda, which was as the sole remaining superpower, and as the one power who is by far and away the military power on the planet, it's now our time to invade Iraq and take control of the resources there. Maybe that is what everyone thought was a great idea. I mean, it makes sense in terms of just maintaining hegemony, because the Democrats are clearly in favor of it. The U.S. has become an economy, a militarized economy, that functions by producing more weapons, which is justified by further wars. And this is what it can do. It can't negotiate well. I mean, it has no interest in doing that. It isn't going to, I don't know, have some kind of exchange programs. No, it wants to use its military force, which is so extreme, to rule the world. The problem is, really, though, when you look at these wars, how is it possible that the U.S. has had so much trouble subduing the Iraqi population? I mean, this is a military question that must be puzzling so many people. So the only recourse is some kind of use of nuclear weapons, because it doesn't seem to be able to assert its strength in conventional military terms. And especially today, after all these years in Iraq, where the military is overextended and economically it can't sustain this. It's just, I mean, for people to think about some kind of quick lightning strike against Iran, I mean, this is what you hear now. I mean, they must be delusional. Must be on drugs or something. It's really going to be, you know, the age-old question of populations without property, challenging those who do, so that they can live in a decent, simple way. Whether it's in India with the dams, or Europe with the immigrants, and France, or anywhere around the world, or you mentioned Venezuela, all the Latin American countries now have kind of more nationalized situations where ordinary people are having a voice. In Brazil, you have a rubber worker elected president, and so on. No, I mean this must be just scaring the ruling people in the U.S. To no end. And so it seems to me, therefore, that if we talk about Iraq, or if we talk about immigration in Europe, or any of these problems, it really would be useful, I think, to frame it in this context. It is. It has to do with power. It has to do with democracy. It has to do with a few taking advantage of the many. And until or unless we build institutions where more and more people have a voice and are able to live simple, decent lives, we'll continue to have these horrible catastrophes. Are you familiar with ZNet and Michael Albert?
Yes.
Okay, and he talks a lot about Paracon, participatory economy. So, I mean, I think that is not necessarily that model, but a model, an alternative economy based on participation and justice. And I know that there are meetings around the world and examples around the world and a local level where people are beginning to do this. For example, here in town, the town is run by a few families to the detriment of the whole community. Unfortunately, my Italian is terrible, and so I feel very hampered, because if I talk with people, it's difficult. But I want to begin talking with a neighbor. Who do you know? Because, I mean, I've done this already, and there's a handful of people. But I think that's the only solution. You have to organize. You have to talk to people who share that concern and try to build some alternative. And I think it's also useful to make it very explicit. It's not just that, for example, here, that we want the disco to close at 12 instead of 4:30, or we don't want the big boats to make all the waves, or whatever the problem is. I think it's very useful to say, we don't want it to be the right of a few people to make decisions that impact the lives of so many people. I mean, it has to be put into those terms.
so that people understand that we need to build alternative institutions. I mean, there's some youth from here, but for the most part, they don't even live here. But I guess it would have to begin with local people coming together to answer the question, what do we do, what do we want to do, what do we need, regardless of where you are, in building something that's an alternative, where they have a real voice. I mean, that seems fundamental. I mean, to try to move in some kind of direction like that. But obviously, you know, it's like who controls the land, who controls the job, who controls the access to education and money. And so how far can you get with that? If you are insightful and persistent, the odds are good that by the time you're 15, you will already have been weeded out some way. You won't, maybe you dropped out of school because, you know, didn't allow for your sensibility. You have identified the problem. It's just it's a huge numbers of people who really don't have anything to live for. No meaning in life. Absolutely. Nihilism. I agree. Absolutely. Even it extends to the privileged people because they're chasing their tail, you know, trying to get more money and so on. And I talk with my wife about this all the time, and we have a nice place on the lake. We look out the window. This is good. But I don't have three people to talk to that I can be who I am. You know, because every time you talk to them, pretty soon you find yourself in an uncomfortable situation where I said, well, geez, you know what, next time I'm just not going to say anything. Just go and I'll have my dinner and, oh, that's nice, you know. What do you do? Yeah, it becomes very meaningless. You can't be you. You cannot enjoy life at the most fundamental level where I feel relaxed because I feel secure. I have enough money in the bank, I have a job, I'm financially, for the next year and a half, I'm okay. I know if I get sick, I have health. I don't. How many people have that? So now, if I'm with friends, I can joke, I can laugh, I can make fun of the government, I can do whatever, I can be who I am. You can't even do that because you might say the wrong thing. That's a pretty dire situation. You're welcome.